Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is a newsy day, and we start with the state of the Massachusetts Republican Party. Tonight, the current chair of the state party, Jim Lyons, is seeking re-election to his third term. But his bid comes with a spotty record. Lyons is facing heat for potentially violating campaign finance law while pursuing opposition research on then-candidate for governor Maura Healey. He's also under fire for spending scarce resources on investigating members of his own committee. Currently, the party is overdue on roughly $86,000 in bills. Now, all of this as Republicans hold no statewide offices, have lost seats in the legislature, down to just 26 now. Thousands of voters have removed themselves as registered Republicans from the state voting rolls, and there is a struggle inside the party about identity. So, with us now to talk about what's at stake in tonight's vote, Lisa Kaczynski, reporter for Politico, author of the Massachusetts Playbook, and Ed Lyons, no relation to Jim Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and writer. Lisa, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And Ed, welcome back to you, too.
Good to be back, and hi, Lisa.
Oops, I lost you there a little bit, Ed, so I'm going to start with Lisa while we check Ed's sound a little bit. Lisa, I'm going to ask you for a prediction. Based on your reporting, do you think Jim Lyons, I know this is prognosticating, but do you think he gets reelected tonight?
Look, it's going to be really close. From everything I'm hearing, and I was checking in with both sides yesterday, you know, there's whip counting efforts going on. This is like a real, big deal here. It's going to be really close. And there are still some other candidates who are in the mix, potentially, who could push this to multiple ballots, siphon votes away from the two main players, who are Jim Lyons and Amy Carnevale. So I don't know. There's a chance he could get reelected. There's a segment of the state committee who are the people who vote on this who are very loyal to Jim and really think that there is, as Jim has asserted, you know, an effort to undermine his leadership that they don't like.
Okay.
So he could.
So Lisa, what I want to do now is kind of break this out in two pieces. Now, everything is related, but we have two sets of things going on here, I think. One is questions about just competency of leadership as a state party chair and a set of criticisms around that. And Lyons, as you say, arguing that people have been seeking to undermine him in that role. And then we have some existential questions about a moderate GOP in the state, an more extreme or more right Trump party in the state. And I want to first ask you, is it fair to say those things are interrelated, but we have two different things going on?
Yeah, I think that's a good summation of it, because kind of the main arguments against Jim Lyons continuing to lead the party is that he has led the party in this hard right pro-Trump direction, kind of nationalized, the party a little bit in rhetoric. And at the same time, the party has, you know, lost seats in the, everything that you ran down at the top here, the party's lost seats in the legislature. There are no more statewide officers. Charlie Baker, you know, the now former governor, could have potentially struggled and or lost in a, you know, Republican primary against a more conservative pro-Trump, Trump-endorsed candidate. I think they are definitely interrelated.
So let me check now and see if we've got Republican activist Ed Lyons back on a clear line. Ed, I'm going to test your line by asking you if we've got you.
You got me.
All right, so we've got you back. So, Ed, I think you just heard Lisa and I talking about this separation between the leadership issues and the party identity issues, and I know they're not completely inseparable, but one might reasonably ask, with the levels of accusation and concern about fiscal management, the party has, a little more than $100,000 to its name with payroll and expenses. It's got weak fundraising. There's been losses. There are no statewide office holders in the Republican Party. How is there, from an accountability standpoint, how is there still a conversation about leadership here? What do we need to understand to round out that picture? Does that make sense, Ed Lyons?
It does. What you have to understand is the NSGP is not operating like a political party anymore. They're not trying to get to 51%. They're not trying to manage resources very well. They've sort of all internalized that they can't win elections anymore, which is how Jim Lyons got reelected after two disastrous years last time to an excellent candidate, State Representative Sean Dooley, who would have been great. We lost because a lot of people are just saying you can't win anymore. Let's just have a good time.
Ed, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. We just do not have good sound from you. I'll paraphrase what you just said. I'm gonna say goodbye to you here, Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republic activist and writer. Always enjoy having you on the show. We're gonna let Ed go. Thanks for that, Ed. So, Lisa, part of what Ed is saying to us there is, well, you've got the wrong point. The point is not to win races. Is that, in your assessment with your reporting, where the kind of the conversation in the state party is, purism versus winning in a very moderate state?
That's the point that it seemed to have gotten to. And that's, again, one of the main arguments, another main argument against Jim Lyons' continued leadership is that, you know, along with going hard right and, you know, pro-Trump, that it's also, yeah, there's become a lot of focus on kind of these purity tests, these very conservative purity tests. And we know from history in Massachusetts, this is a state that has time and time and again elected very moderate Republican governors when a Republican makes it to that office. And it's just not something that connects with voters in the state, the majority of whom are independent, the next biggest block of whom are Democrats. And we've seen that in how Republican congressional candidates, statewide candidates have just fallen election after election under Jim Lyons.
So let's do party identity here for a minute, Lisa Kuczynski, as we talk about the election tonight for a new state chair for the Massachusetts GOP. I'm going to play a little bit of sound from a conversation we had with Amy Carnevale. She's a member of the state party. She is, as you've mentioned, the key appears to be key challenger against Jim Lyons in this vote tonight. And we spoke with her on Trump for President, talking to us back in 2020 during the Republican convention at that time.
So I would say certainly the economy remains a paramount issue for voters supporting President Trump here in the Commonwealth. That was the driving fact. The economy was the driving factor for me in supporting the president 4 years ago, and it continues to be the driving factor in this election.
And she was supporting Trump at the time in the election. Much of the sort of party existential question, as it's been pitted, has loosely put Lyons on one side and Carnevale on the other, right? So you've got your Trumpists with Lyons. He has referred repeatedly to Governor Charlie Baker. And that wasn't even Freudian. I honestly don't know where that came from.
Not yet.
Well, he's pretty clear that's not where he's going.
Yeah.
So former Governor Charlie Baker, as, you know, Republican in name only. And I want to note, Baker repeatedly called on Lyons to resign as state party chair. And then, you know, sort of casting Amy Carnevale as the moderate. But this is someone who voted for Trump and has supported Trump twice. So are we setting up a real comparison, or is there something more, you know, complex going on there?
There's something more complex going on, and this does kind of unfortunately get lost in some of, you know, the online talk and even some of the reporting on the Mass GOP, because it is easy to characterize it solely as a split between, you know, conservative Trumpers and, you know, more moderate Charlie Bakers. But Amy Carnevale is someone who kind of sits in the middle of those, and that is something that she's really running on in trying to become chair of the party, is that she can be this bridge between conservatives. You know, she is more conservative than some of the more moderate Baker folks. She is a Trump Baker voter. She's voted for both of them. So she's kind of trying to use that to bridge the gap between those two sides, actually to win the chairmanship election.
So I can imagine a listener saying, okay, fine, whatever. I don't really know what's going on in the state Democratic Party. I don't need to know what's going on in the state Republican Party. I need to know what's going to happen in housing over the next few years and jobs, you know, and the T. So what are the stakes for the average person in how this turns out tonight, Lisa?
The stakes in this are really, none of those things are going to get answered by tonight. Sorry to anyone who's listening for that. But what will happen tonight is, you know, the Mass GOP right now has a chance to kind of, you know, choose its next path forward, whether it continues down the path it's on or tries for a reset. You know, even with a new chair, there's no guarantee that it's going to happen with how just plagued by infighting this party has been for years now. But if they don't manage to turn themselves around and start winning back some seats, whether it's in the legislature, maybe eventually getting back into statewide office, this state will be under one party rule. And that does affect everything that, you know, that you talked about, the T, housing, all of that stuff, jobs. You know, we see that right now. I mean, there is a reason that voters time and time again in Massachusetts, at least over the past 30 years, have elected, you know, a Republican as governor as a kind of check on that. And we don't have that right now. And if, you know, the GOP continues down the path it is, regardless of who the leader is, you know, there won't be a check on that one party rule anymore at the statewide level.
And in fact, I think it's fair to say, Lisa, that the bulk of the time over the last several decades, Massachusetts has, in fact, relied on the governor's office as a check on a Democratic legislature. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why you've only seen two Democratic governors in the past 30 years.
So what's interesting about that then is, should you have a state party on the Republican side that is completely gutted, let's assume, just for argument's sake, Maura Healey serves 8 years as governor. And so for 8 years, you have a Democratic governor and what will likely be, given the history of the Massachusetts State House, a Democratic legislature in the Massachusetts State House. This would be a party that could not probably field a viable candidate and give that candidate the financial support that it would need, you know, 4 years from now, 8 years from now, either, to reintroduce those checks and balances, if that's what the voters want, back into our mix. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that's kind of the juncture that the Mass GOP is at right now. They don't have the money coming in to support these types of candidates, and they also don't have the bench. Candidate recruitment is a massive problem for the GOP right now, whereas if you look at the Democratic side, there's more potential candidates for higher office than they know what to do with, given the fact that there aren't that many seats open. So, Republicans really need to, and that is kind of the thrust. Both sides of this, I should be clear, both sides of this chair election, Jim Lyons, Amy Carnevale, other candidates, they're all talking about trying to grow the bench of candidates. That is the overriding goal of anyone who is running for chair of this party. It is getting lost right now in, you know, the various infighting and feuds and personal gripes and stuff that, you know, keeps spilling over into the public domain. But that is what needs to happen. And there are candidates who could emerge and who have stayed out of this drama, like Taunton Mayor Shauna O'Connell, former U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Andrew Lelling. There are others that could run for these statewide offices in the future. But right now, they don't have the support of a party apparatus to help them do it. And associating themselves with the GOP at this time just brings you into a lot of drama.
All right. Lisa Kashinsky is a reporter for Politico and author of the Massachusetts Playbook. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Well, welcome to the world of point spreads, parlays, prop bets, because you can now legally bet on sports in Massachusetts. You can bet on the Bruins, Celtics, and of course the Super Bowl, but also, let's say, the outcome of a Korean baseball game or Australian rules football. And oddly enough, Nathan's Famous hot dog eating contest and a whole lot more. In a policy change that has been years in the making, as of 10 a.m. today, three Massachusetts casinos are taking in-person cash bets: Plain Ridge Park Casino, MGM Springfield, and Encore Boston Harbor.
First bettors placing their first initial bets in our WinBet Sport kiosk located by the main cortex.
That sound courtesy of WBUR reporter Walter Wuthman, who, as you can hear from the background noise, is joining us from the Encore as things are unfolding. Walt, hello.
Good morning, Tiziana.
Is it busy, Walt? Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, it is busy. It's probably busier than your typical Tuesday morning. I'm standing right in front of the Sports Bets kiosk section, where at 10 o'clock they count it down very dramatically. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then 30 people place the first legal sports bets in Massachusetts on these kiosks.
And as I understand it, Walt, there's two ways to bet there. You can go to these electronic kiosks where you don't, you know, speak with a person, you insert cash, you place a bet on a digital screen, or you can go to a counter and talk to a person and place a bet there. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So this section, there's like two banks of these huge fancy screens. They're really bright. They're really easy to use. There's people using them right now, actually. But if you walk across the casino floor, there's live tellers. There's like 10 booths, and there's an actual human being who can help you place your first sports bet.
And the first legal sports bet
in Massachusetts.
That is a fair point, Walt, and an important one. And I do want to note, digital betting, online betting, debit card betting, not in the mix yet here in
Correct.
The Commonwealth. Walt, in those first bets placed, my understanding is some of that was curated, and there were some fairly famous figures who participated. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Definitely. Former Patriots players Matt Light and Ty Law, former Red Sox legend Johnny Damon. And I regret to tell you, Tiziana, he said he wanted to bet on the Red Sox to make the playoffs, but he couldn't do it. So he's betting instead on the Eagles to win the Super Bowl.
So wait, he couldn't do it, meaning he could not in good conscience do it, or he physically...
Not in good conscience. Yeah. He doesn't think this team is making the playoffs.
Oh my gosh. Well, you just made some news with that one, Walt. All right, before I let you go, and we'll check in with you again later, Walt, but before I let you go, what are the trends? What are the trends in how many people are betting, who you're seeing betting, what kinds of bets are getting placed? Are we all over the place, or are there some themes here?
It's a little all over the place, and I mean, it's definitely like a party celebratory atmosphere here today. Who knows if it's going to be this busy every day, but I mean, the state is estimating that they're going to bring in anywhere from like $30 million to $60 million of new tax revenue every year through legalized sports betting.
And that's the tax revenue on a much larger nut that would be the transactions themselves, right, Walt?
Exactly.
Okay, so Walter Withman, WBUR reporter, you're at the Encore. We will come back to you a little bit later and check in again on how things are unfolding. So we'll talk to you in a bit, Walt. Thanks.
Thanks.
Okay, so mixed feelings in the Commonwealth about this change. Some really want it, some don't. And with policy changes come other changes. So throughout the debates about legalizing sports betting in the Commonwealth, we've spoken with our next two guests, and we wanted to check in with them today. Andrew Zimbalist is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Smith College. He's been following the legalization of sports betting nationwide. And Victor Matheson is a Professor of Economics and Accounting at Holy Cross with a specialization in sports economics and gambling. Andrew, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning, Tiziana.
And Victor, you as well. Welcome back.
Well, it's great to be here.
So we've come to know the two of you of having just a little bit of different worldview on betting. So I want to start by just your reactions. The moment's actually here, and we heard it happening real time with Walt Withman there. Andrew Zimbalist, what are your reactions?
Well, you know, to me, the key point that was brought out is that the state is hoping to collect $30 to $50 million in revenue. That's what this is all about. Massachusetts doesn't want to stand by while adjacent states are allowing this to happen and pulling in all of the revenue. Of course, if it were completely illegalized in Massachusetts, then people would have to go to surrounding states. And I suspect what it will mean down the road is that some of the limitations that are currently in place, such as online betting, will be lifted, because the state won't want to miss out on the revenue connected to that either. One of the things that the state does allow, again, in a limited way, is betting on college games. And I think that's particularly dangerous. But we'll hold off on that until Victor has a say.
Well, so, and let me just note for listeners, a couple of just clarifications there. Again, we are at cash-only betting right now. And right now, you can only bet in person in three casinos. Over time, there will be more casinos. And there is a time coming in about a month when online betting through a number of vendors will also become possible, although betting on credit in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts will not be allowed. In addition, we are limited here in the Commonwealth to bets on Massachusetts college sports teams unless they are participating in NCAA tournaments. So, first, let me turn to you, Victor. One, I got all that right, yes?
No, you did get all of that exactly right. So this is a fun kind of start, for the people who really like sports gambling. Where sports gambling will really take off in the state here is in early March when we legalize online gaming. So yeah, there are currently three physical locations that you can bet at, and there'll be a couple more being added over the course of the next year. But what really happens here is in early March, there's going to be about 5 million places in the state where you can bet, because you're going to be able to do it on your phone from any one of about 15 different apps. We'll be happy to take your money and allow you to bet, again, on a wide range of sporting events and even some non-sporting events. So you can bet on the Oscars if you're not a sports person.
And I do want to note, as of right now, sports betting is legal in 36 states. That number up by 6 just in recent weeks. And this all kind of came after basically a logjam was broken in 2018 when the Supreme Court struck down the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act of 1992, which was the federal ban on sports betting. So two things I want to get to here, and I'll pick up the thread that you've left hanging for us, Andrew Zimbalist, which is what you think happens with college over time. And as I know from previous conversations with you, what concerns you about that. So let's pick up that thread.
So there are 15.8 million undergraduate students in the United States. Various surveys have suggested that two-thirds of college students bet on sports, and somewhere between 2 and 7%, depending on who's doing the estimating, are problem of the people who participate, they're problem gamblers. That leaves you with somewhere in the neighborhood of 478,000 college students, by these estimates, who are problem gamblers. I think that that not only disrupts the lives of the problem gamblers, but it disrupts the lives of their fellow students in the dormitories. So I think there's a substantial impact there. Another impact is that just like with the Chicago Black Sox in 1919, who were angry at their owner, Charles Comiskey, because he wasn't paying them a competitive salary, they took bribes to blow the 1919 World Series. College students, although they're now, some of them are getting some NIL, name, image, and likeness, or publicity rights income, they're not getting paid in real dollars. And
you mean the athletes?
Of them, the athletes, and a large numbers of them probably feel cheated, and hence are quite susceptible to any approach from gamblers. Same thing might go with the refs. So it does challenge the underlying integrity of the contest, the athletic integrity, as well as potentially damaging the social fabric within the broader university. So I think it's a very serious thing to watch. And, you know, it is legalized now. So people say because it's legalized, we'll be able to watch it better. But I don't know if you can really watch better the life of problem gamblers. What you can watch better are shifts in the gambling odds as the game approaches or as a particular part of the game approaches. And those shifts in gambling odds help you understand the potential for interference by the gamblers or point fixing with the games. So you can better understand that and maybe better control that. But it doesn't solve the larger problems in college sports betting.
So as Andrew Zimbalist, who's a professor emeritus of economics at Smith, reminds us that those numbers would play out at roughly 500,000 college students who could have a sports gambling problem. I'll say if you are struggling with a gambling addiction, you can get help by calling the Massachusetts Problem Gambling Helpline, which is at 800-327-5050. That's 800-327-5050. Turning back to Victor Matheson, professor of economics at Holy Cross. So Victor, what makes those risks worth it? Now, I'm not actually asking an existential question. The state has said, we passed this. We think the risks are worth it because of revenue. You mentioned that revenue. And to point out, sports betting in Massachusetts will be taxed at 15% for in-person bets at casinos and later 20% for online bets. So back that out for us. What is the size of the industry that we could be looking at here in Massachusetts? Because I got to tell you, $50, $60, $70, $80 million, while a lot, also kind of doesn't seem like a lot, Victor.
So I think most people are surprised by the amount of actual gambling that does take place. So if Massachusetts ends up like we're seeing in states like Arizona and New Jersey that have legalized gambling a little bit earlier here, we're probably looking at about $5 billion of wagers being made every year in Massachusetts. The vast majority of those, over 90% of those, will be made on phone, not in the casinos. Even in Vegas, you know, home of all the grand casinos, even there, two-thirds of all sports betting is done on people's phones, not in the casinos. $5 billion means that that's $1,000 of betting being done by every adult on average. And of course, we know a lot of people aren't going to bet at all. So that does mean, again, going right to Andy's point, there are some people who are going to be engaging in a massive amount of gambling and certainly an unhealthy amount of gambling. That being said, we have the gaming companies themselves are probably looking at about $500 million a year in annual revenue. $500 million a year in annual revenue, where does that money come from? Obviously, right out of people's pockets. This is, again, you know, the existential question is this a good thing or a bad thing? To the extent that people enjoy it and it's a form of entertainment, I don't think any economist has a problem with that. To the extent that it is an expensive lesson for some people who think they are too smart for the casinos, they will quickly find out they're not. To the extent that the, you know, again, 1, 2, 5, 7% of people who find that they have a gambling compulsion, this is a significant public health issue. That being said, again, for the vast majority of people, it's a fun and exciting thing that people can do. That is not a particularly harmful, although potentially expensive. But again, Andy's exactly right, that there is a segment of the population that this is wildly problematic for.
So I want to hit just a couple of other things, and I'm going to play a little bit of sound here. Andrew Zimbalist, representatives for professional athlete unions, told the Massachusetts Gaming Commission that the commission should be prepared to take swift action to prevent bettors from harassing players who maybe miss a key free throw that spoils someone's bet. Union reps say the commission should be ready also to potentially ban betting on specific games or sets of games like the World Series, for example. Here's one of those union reps, attorney Jim Eisenberg.
We think it's important that it be made clear that that threat, for lack of a better word, exists in extreme cases where the commission determines it's just not safe for the players to be playing because of threats, intimidation, and the like.
Sports betting has been legal in Las Vegas since the late 1940s. It's been legal in other countries. Is that a legit concern? And do we have evidence from other places to demonstrate that it can be mitigated? Or is it open season should we find ourselves in that situation, Andrew?
Well, look, first of all, I think it's a very real problem. There was a story last week about a college athlete whose team lost a game and some gamblers attacked him physically. And there's no reason why that will continue to happen. We can ask police forces and other people from government to try to watch over that and to minimize it, but they're not going to be able to follow every single player in the United States. You know, you're talking about there are 500,000 athletes in the United States who play college sports, and betting is going to become more and more widespread, and they're going to be betting, as you and Victor have pointed out, there's going to be betting not just on the outcome of games, but on every single play during the game. So there's an enormous amount of betting in action that's out there, and a large number of people who are engaging in it. So I think that the physical danger and the violence problem is there. It's not going to go away. We can mitigate it, yes, but it's going to be there forever.
And Victor Matheson, over the next, let's say, 3 months, what are you watching more closely for as somebody who studies sports economics and gambling?
So I think it'll be interesting to see exactly how many licenses end up going out for the online betting. Again, I know we're talking about this today because of the excitement associated with the first in-person betting.
But again, day one.
Yeah, that's going to be a very, very tiny portion of this whole market. And what'll be interesting is exactly how much revenue is being generated on the online apps. It's coming right in time of March Madness. That's one of the two big sports betting events of the year. It's the Super Bowl and it's March Madness. And the thing, again, just to play off what Andy's saying here is corruption in the game. We can look back to the Black Sox of 1919, but I think most of the sports leagues have realized that this is not a significant issue for them. You know, look at the Celtics here. Jason Tatum, he's their big star. He makes about $32 million a year. He's not going to be throwing games just for a bribe payment by some gambling consortium. Shoeless Joe Jackson back in 1919, he took $5,000 of money to throw the World Series along with a bunch of other teammates. But he was only making $8,000 that year. So that's tempting. That's not going to happen. But that's why most of the big professional leagues have gone full in on gambling, right? So the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, they all have now professional. They all now have gambling sponsors. They have official licensed partners with casinos. So that's going to bring in at least $1 billion a year in sponsorship revenue among the big leagues.
All right.
The NCAA is who's resisting this, again, because they know they're most vulnerable because they have this successful cartel that's kept their wages down to those players. And now here's one of the real harms that's coming from that, because, again, those players are particularly susceptible, just like Andy says.
All right. Victor Matheson of Holy Cross, Andrew Zimbalist of Smith College, thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
And, of course, worth noting as we turn back to Walter Wuthman at the Encore that, of course, former Massachusetts Governor Baker about to be in charge of the NCAA that Victor Matheson was just talking about. He starts at the beginning of March. So, Walt, we'll come back to you back into this moment, which is a first here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I understand that you wanted to see how it was going to work and you placed a small bet of your own just to see how the mechanics go. Is that right?
I did. I placed a bet for research purposes with my money, not WBUR's, but to see how these kiosks work. And it is really easy. You can see how they're trying to make this as accessible to as many people as they can. So I was kind of scrolling through all the odds and all the lines. I saw the Knicks are playing the Lakers tonight. I don't really care about either team, but I put $10 on the Knicks to beat the Lakers. They're favored by -2.5. So the Knicks need to beat the Lakers by more than 3 points for my $10 bet to make me $18.
All right. Well,
so stay tuned. Stay tuned on that.
I will at least personally check in with you on that later. Walter Wuthman, again, WBUR reporter, has been at the Encore Casino this morning, one of three casinos that is now taking in-person cash betting in Massachusetts. Walt, thanks.
Thank you.
So sometimes here on the show, we book a guest ahead of time, and we don't necessarily know exactly what the news will be on the day that they come or how we're going to be thinking about the news in that moment. And today is one of those days, and we're so grateful that we had a chance to schedule a guest that feels so appropriate to the national and local moment that we're in. Isaac Yablo is stepping into a new role for the City of Boston, Senior Advisor for Community Safety. And the city wants a strong public health lens going forward in that role. Isaac is here with us in Studio 2. Isaac, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with a warning for listeners. We will be talking about trauma, violence, safety for the next several minutes. So listeners, be aware of that. Isaac, we are in such a... Okay, so before the show started, right above you, you can't see them because they're behind you on the screen. Mm-hmm. On the wall, I have two televisions up, CNN and Fox News, which I always have in the background on closed caption. Mm-hmm. Just before the show starts, I peek up at the screen, and they are showing video. Mm-hmm. Of the killing in Memphis. You can see that I am shaken and taken aback by it. I had not watched Tyree Nichols's murder, death, accused. The five police officers are accused of murder. And there it is on the screen. Mm-hmm. We are in a moment where everyone is confronted with the pornographic of violence and trauma. And our young Black men who disproportionately know themselves to be potential victims are being confronted with that all the time. Mm-hmm. So as you come into this community safety advisory role, and there's a public health dimension to it, how do you get your head around and think about this moment that we're in?
Yeah, so I am honored to be in the role. I did enter the role at a relatively tough time, I would say. The goal of taking a public health approach is really to look at root causes of this violence, community violence. What happened down in Memphis is more than a tragedy. It shouldn't have happened. I am a Black man, and so I walk in my Black skin every day, and I know what it feels like to be uncomfortable, not in our skin, but just in where we're at as a society in terms of how we're dealing with Black men, just to be blunt. Again, what happened in Memphis is a tragedy, and it's something that I struggle with because, you know, as Black people and people of color, we've been dealing with traumas like this for years, and so part of me feels like this is regular programming, but then the other part of me feels like each time there's another person that loses their life that looks like me, it rips another part of my heart out. So the approach that I'm taking to this work is just with people on my back, my ancestors on my back, and the people that have lost their lives on my back, just trying to make them proud in the work that we're going to do moving forward.
I really appreciate that answer, and I'm mindful of your relative youth at under 30. This is a big responsibility, just in terms of what you are carrying. Do you have a support network around you as you think about advising a big city, the city of Boston, about community safety that will carry you and support you and advise you and keep you whole while you're trying to do this every day?
Yeah, I definitely have a very good support system. I have a wonderful wife that keeps me sane. But more importantly, I have people that I work with every single day as a part of this network that I've built out and are working to continue to build out. It's full of individuals that I can talk to about the work, but I can also confide in. So I definitely have people that are on my side. We have the same goal in mind, which is to create a safer Boston for all the residents.
And what does, so let's bring the heart, the head, and the soul together now, because one of the things that both we've known you for in the past here on Radio Boston and that you're very public about is your commitment to data.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the head, right? And the head, heart, and soul, when they all come together, what does safety, community safety, look like? How do you prioritize it? What do you measure it? How do you measure it? How do you know when people are safe?
Yeah, I think that there's obviously you have to look at quantitative metrics and the qualitative metrics. I think historically what cities do is they look at a reduction of, violent acts or an increase of, graduation, right? So, but I think there's qualitative nuance. I believe that fear of crime is a very real metric. And speaking where we're at right now, we had a young person lose their life. Recently, we have what's going on in Memphis and other places in the United States. So fear of crime is a legitimate thing. So as we're working and looking for measurables, looking at quantitative statistics, because the quantitative statistics, the trends will help us to allocate resources in the places that are that need it most. But then the qualitative metrics will help us to understand, based on the resources that we're providing, are they working? Yes or no? Right. So it's very nuanced, but it's a task that I think that we as a city are prepared to take on.
So I want to just round out a reference that you made. On Sunday, it was reported that there was a shooting in Mattapan. 11:30 a.m. on Sunday, the mm-hmm. police reported that they believed it was a targeted shooting of an individual and that the shooting was fatal. And mm-hmm. we now have reporting from yesterday that the victim was a 13-year-old boy mm-hmm. from Norwood. And we've had a number of other conversations here on Radio Boston over the last several months about kids in schools in yeah. Boston. And one framing about kids are being violent in schools, they're being violent in schoolyards. We're seeing increased violence in the Boston public schools. And another framing that is we are seeing increased fear for kids in the Boston public schools. We are seeing kids take more extreme steps to feel that they can protect themselves because they don't feel protected.
Mm-hmm.
That is a key piece of what this advisory job focuses on. And you have done work with youth workers or what the city calls street workers for quite a bit of time already in the past.
Yeah.
So as you lay out a landscape of what you're going to measure, what you're going to think about, what levers you think you want to push on there, how are you thinking about that piece?
It's extremely nuanced. I think, again, to the point about being data-driven, I just want to look at the data. Right now, things are very polarized within the Boston Public School system. It's not a reflection of the system in general. I think that these incidents that have happened recently are terrible and tragic. Same thing with this incident that happened on Sunday. I had just left church and I went immediately from church to the scene. And it's a scene that was, compared to other scenes, fairly calm, but still you could feel the aura that things were just not right, for lack of a better word. So I think as I moving forward, it's just we have to be cognizant of what these young people are actually going through. The fight is not necessarily against the Boston Public School System, the police department, certain politicians. The fight is against the culture that is taking grip of our young people. And the culture is a culture that is not forgiving. It's a culture that is not respectful of systems. And it's a culture that does not value life the way that we would want our young people to value their lives. So as I look into this role in the future, this role, I look at what I'm, the task that I'm up against is fighting a culture that does not value the lives of our children.
So I want to leave the full weight of the focus on culture and what you said firmly here in the middle of the table. Mm-hmm. And I want to pick up another piece. Mm-hmm. You are the child of professors. Mm-hmm. You are pursuing your PhD at MIT. You believe in the power of data. Mm-hmm. So I want to take this data piece and I want to talk about it as a superpower and ask you how one can use data as a power or a superpower to bring into the mix that we've just left on the table with everything else we're talking about. What is the potential and the possibility there? And why do you believe in it as a core tool so deeply? Educate us about that.
I think that data, depending on how ethically it's gathered, right, can be an amazing reflection of people, systems, processes. And for me, as a person that is primarily qualitative, I am a very much a people person. I like to use data. And I think, again, going back to metrics of data and metrics of success that we're going to be looking at, again, quantitatively, you have to look at that because that's how large entities like government secure funding, right? Because, you know, we need to have some sort of quantitative metric.
Reduction in violent crimes, fewer shootings, fewer thefts and robberies, right. Sexual assault is down, right. Fewer guns, those kinds of things.
Right, and then an increase of graduation, right? Like increase, you know,
the
things
positives
like that.
As well.
Exactly.
Enfranchisement, employment, economic well-being.
Right.
Okay.
Right, so all of those things, but then, like, again, going back to the quantitatives, like if we have all of these things, like if I've created 1,000 new jobs and the community that needs it most is not feeling the creation of those new jobs, did we really do what we were setting out to do? And so I just leave it at that.
We're speaking with Isaac Yablo, who's the new senior advisor for community safety for the city of Boston, and noting that that role used to be called senior advisor for public safety. The city has changed it to a broader focus of community safety, wanting to really underscore the public health lens when we talk about safety. So who is and isn't safe?
On a day-to-day reality, there's people that probably feel that they aren't safe. Then there's the individuals that have been adversely impacted by systems of racism that have festered and birthed issues surrounding safety. I would say that it's a tough question.
I'm mindful, and I want to apologize to you because I'm mindful. I sounded glib or almost gotcha, and that's actually not what I'm looking to do with that question. I'm looking to understand how you think about that framing and where our vulnerabilities are in the city of Boston around safety.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's really no way to sugarcoat the answer that there have been communities in the city of Boston that have been adversely impacted by community violence since our city was founded, right? Mm-hmm. And for individuals residing in certain communities within the city, going to the metrics, I can tell them about a reduction in violence, but a lot of the time it's not felt on a day-to-day basis. For the individuals that are residing in communities that have been adversely impacted by racism, obviously there are levels and there's issues surrounding safety that are not felt in other communities.
So, for example, historically Roxbury or a Dorchester or a Mattapan that has been systematically disenfranchised from resources, job opportunities, quality schools versus the Back Bay, where we know, for example, that there's a significant life expectancy difference there versus the neighborhoods that we're talking about.
Right. And I want to go back to, like, you know, the compound trauma that some of these communities are dealing with. So if I've talked to people that, you know, if there's a shooting on their street, they're not going to necessarily feel more unsafe. To them, it's, again, regular programming. This mm-hmm. is what we've been dealing with since I was born. So am I going to feel more unsafe when this just continues to happen? Yes and no. Again, Boston is a safe city compared to other major cities. We have some of the lowest numbers. But it, as I've said before, if you're talking to a person that lives on a street where there's acts of violence that are committed every year, it's going to be a hard time selling to them that we are a safe city when it's the same communities that have been impacted by this violence.
So that implies community safety comes with serious structural change.
Yes. And I would also add, though, that, you know, these communities that have been dealing with this violence are extremely resilient and have been, and the levels of collective efficacy within the community are extremely high. Oftentimes it's a byproduct of this violence that they've been dealing with.
Can you explain for our listeners this term collective efficacy?
Yeah, I would just feel it in short, it's a feeling of social cohesion. I would say that there's a feeling of it's, you know, we have all heard the saying, it takes a village to raise a child. So that feeling of I'm not just living as an individual within society, but I have relationships, I have individual relationships, I have a community, and then I have a society that I'm actually caring for. And so collective efficacy would mean that, you know, if we're all living on the same block, we can all care about, you know, the quality of life on our street, right? And oftentimes in communities where you're dealing with disenfranchisement, collective efficacy is one of the first things that it can either go away very quickly, but it can also be built very quickly, because sometimes you feel like, well, if resources are limited, I got to worry about myself. It's kind of like what they tell you on an airplane, secure your mask before you mm-hmm. scare others. But then at the same time, people that are going through some of the hardest times oftentimes will come together because they know that there's when there's camaraderie and there's a team, if you will, it might make the situation a little bit easier.
So in our last minute together, life is always full of both joy and pain, right? Happiness and challenge, hard truths and happy truths. As you approach this work, where do you think the joy will be?
The joy for me is already started. It's working together with community to make sure that community is safe. The Boston Police Department is like the last resort for me. I want to do everything that I can to work with the community to build, you know, different tools related to informal social control and just make them feel like that the community is really owning the work that's being done and that it's not being done outside of what they want. I don't want it to feel like siloed work. I want the work to be collective. So,
Isaac Yablo is Boston Mayor Michelle Wu's new senior advisor on community safety. I appreciate you coming to Studio 2, and I appreciate you sitting down and having a really thoughtful conversation with us. Thank you, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Anytime.
That's our show for today. This is Radio Boston.